well to remind ourselves of the unusual breadth of his career. He has had over 30 years of active military service. During the past three decades, he has served six presidents and was White House Chief of Staff for Presidents Nixon and Ford. He was senior military advisor to Henry Kissinger when the latter was assistant to the President for National Security Affairs. He coordinated preparations for Nixon's historic visit to China. General Haig served as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. European Command and was also Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. His most recent government post was that of Secretary of State in the Reagan administration. He is currently Chairman of the United Technologies International Advisory Committee. Persons who have questions for General Haig are asked to please identify themselves. And it is my honor and pleasure to present General Haig.
Thank you. I'll just say a few words so you get used to my voice level and get your juices flowing. I'm here at Northern Michigan University and will be here till about noon tomorrow. And this involves a number of classroom presentations and a formal lecture this evening with both students and faculty, and a very remarkable meeting with the young high school students of Northern Michigan this morning. My general observation would be the sophisticated level of student interest I have found in contemporary foreign policy and national security questions. And I think goes without saying that was very much in evidence in the exchange with the college level students and of course the faculty, but was surprisingly very evident with the young high school children, which is an important reflection of the state of repair of your education here in Northern Michigan. And I found it to be very, very impressive. Tonight I'll make some general observations about the need for greater balance in American foreign policy. I am a Republican. I support President Reagan and his re-election. Notwithstanding, it's been my practice when I serve a president to tell him what I think he should hear rather than what he wants to hear. Sometimes that's less than pleasant. But that has to be the style of a public official if he's to really make a contribution to the man he serves. In that instance, it was President Reagan. Now, in my remarks, I will talk about balance in the context of improving our relationships with those who share our values around the world in Western Europe, Japan, with the developing world, perhaps in particular because of the changing nature of the world and the increasing importance that the developing world plays for the American people and their interests. And finally, some observations on the Soviet Union and future U.S.-Soviet relations and their prospects. Okay, I welcome your questions. Yeah.
Mr. Secretary, you mentioned in your speech earlier this morning your disapproval of the covert actions taken against the Nicaraguan government.
Yeah.
And with all the news concerning the Boland Amendment last mm-hmm. year and mm-hmm. American covert activity mm-hmm. and the recent news that supposedly Americans mine the harbors mm-hmm. outside of Nicaragua, your opinion towards or that type of policy, first of all, do you think it's helpful to our long-term interest? And secondly, if it's not, what would you like to be seen done instead?
Yeah. Well, the reason I am leery of covert action of the kind that may or may not be underway in Central America is not necessarily because I am morally opposed to the right of a nation state to indulge in covert activity, but rather because I believe that in modern America, the aversion of the American people to such activities and more importantly, the inability of an ill-disciplined government to keep the activity covert has convinced me that it's always ineffective. It simply does not work. And it's its practical applications rather than its moral applications that give me pause.
How can we best achieve our long-term interests in Central America, in your opinion, at this point?
Well, in my opinion, and I have written extensively on this in my book, which I understand is on the shelves today, is that we have not taken the matter with sufficient care and effectiveness to the real sources of the problem as they should pertain to American concern, and that is Castro's Cuba and the Soviet Union. That are the catechists, the logisticians, and the directors of what is going on in Central America as it pertains to Nicaragua and the insurgency in Salvador.
Do you believe that poverty, the long-term interests of the past history of the United States foreign policy, especially pertaining to the third world, of supporting authoritarian regimes as opposed to a communist dictatorship in return for those people oftentimes suffering greater human rights abuses than the American mm-hmm. people were aware of. Do you think that cost us in the long run, or are we paying for those mistakes now?
Well, I think it's always risky to support any regime, whether it be totalitarian or authoritarian, which is in itself guilty of violating the basic principles for which our nation stands. On the other hand, as Americans, we have been less than discriminating in recent years between the two types of regimes. A totalitarian regime is one which, through ideological conviction, pursues policies which run directly contrary to the interest of the American people. An authoritarian regime pursues those policies not from ideological conviction, but more importantly from environment, from a lack of political sophistication, from as a direct consequence of their legacy, an inherited process. And therefore, they are always somewhat easier to change and to bring towards a democratic process over time. And therefore, if we are to pursue policies in the developing world in which we are so, if you will, turned off by authoritarian regimes, that those policies have the consequence of driving them not from authoritarianism to democracy, but to totalitarianism of the kind we see in Iran today, then I think we have made misjudgments. Yeah.
You said this morning with student leaders at the breakfast that you were at that you were violently and justifiably opposed to the apartheid policies of South Africa.
I don't like to use the word violently.
Okay, I can.
As an ex-soldier, it's always misinterpreted.
Being that you are a McGough Distinguished Lecturer, I don't know whether you're aware of the controversy that has surrounded Mr. McGough and his ties with South Africa.
No.
At NMU, do you see a contradiction in that statement and the fact that you are?
Well, I don't know. I don't know the details of the controversy you're referring to. I do know that my lecture here was negotiated, as all of the lectures of the universities and colleges I've spoken to, through my agent. And I've been this year and this past year and a half at Yale, at Princeton, at the University of Michigan, at several Florida universities, at West Point, at Lemoyne College. I'll be at the University of Colorado next week. I have always learned, and I believe very vigorously, that to pop off and make value judgments about a subject I don't know anything about would be foolish in the extreme. If you want to ask me about apartheid, I'm happy to reiterate for you that the position of the United States government, especially during the time I was Secretary of State, and has continued today, is one of abhorrence of apartheid. But I again raise the question in the context of the question preceding, that we Americans can sit here in splendid isolationism and pop off and make value judgments about what's right or what's wrong around the world. The question is, are we going to make a positive influence on change? And in that regard, some of our attitudes with respect to apartheid, I think, are not contributing to change, but precisely the opposite, are making it more difficult for change to occur. Let me be specific. The pressure applied publicly by the Carter administration on the government of Pretoria made it very difficult, because that's a government that proceeds under a democratic process. Whether you accept the fact that it's a democracy or not is less important, that its procedures are democratic. It has a parliament. And when we attack them continually, it makes that issue very difficult for a leadership in that country to deal with. It becomes a test of manhood. And frequently they become more rigid rather than less rigid. The way you deal with that is very strong and urgent pressure privately, not in the public sector.
What about disinvestment?
Disinvestment is another very good point. I've just been in Southern Africa. I spent time in Namibia. I met with the multi-party Congress in Namibia. That consists of the founders of SWAPO, who have since left SWAPO, the Maoists, the Marxists, and one very lonely Afrikaner. They are concerned about our policies. And the one single thing that was consistent among them all was their suspicion of and their aversion to the Soviet Union. I then went to South Africa, where I met with the chief of the Zulus, with the colored leadership of the Indian groups, and several other black leaders who are all activists against apartheid. And every one of them, I did not see the bishop, who I understand would take a contrary position, but all of these leaders said that disinvestment is a policy which will reap misery for the black populations and the colored populations of Africa, and they're opposed to it. What they want is a viable economic South Africa with equal opportunities for all. And I think that's the view that we Americans share, rather than to impose misery on people who are already suffering.
I have one final question, if you will. You mentioned that you've worked under six presidents. Could you tell us your favorite president, and which was your worst president to work under?
Well, unlike the White House staff, who love to give report cards on the cabinet officer, I've never given report cards on presidents. I think it's a presumptuous thing to do.
Say that you're interested in students, obviously, with your speaking around the country and your reception today from high school students. Why is it important for young people to be interested in what goes on around the world and today's politics?
Yeah, well, as you know, I made a flippant statement this morning. I said one of our Washington pundits said that politics is the only game in the world where the spectators always lose. And I said that's true or not true to the effect we become participants rather than spectators. And I think it's vitally important for our young people today to develop an interest in and a viewpoint of contemporary politics, and hopefully to participate as they mature and enter society. And that's what makes a democracy viable. That's what ensures that the interest of the people rather than the politicians dominate the process.
Without issuing a report card then, what's your assessment of Reagan's foreign policy without you in the administration?
Well, I am a very great admirer of George Shultz. I worked with him in the Nixon administration. I think he has been doing a very fine job. Unfortunately, he has had to face the very same handicaps that I faced, with an ill-disciplined national security structure and a White House staff that mucks around in affairs that they know little about. It's interesting that George Shultz used a different technique than I did. He turned the other cheek, but he suffered the same outcome.
What's going on with the foreign policy?
Well, in some respects, it's improved. and I think it's improved partially as a result of my departure. It drew attention to certain things. That's certainly true with respect to the pipeline sanction, which was finally lifted, although I was violently opposed to its imposition in the first place. It's true of arms control, which has now received greater emphasis from the administration, and I felt that it should while I was there. It's been less true, perhaps, in the Middle East, where I think recent events confirm that American foreign policy has been a serious failure. And I am reluctant to criticize the Central American policy because the president missed his opportunity. If he was going to do something different in Central America, he had to do it early on in his administration. He now will not be able to do that because of congressional opposition and the exigencies of an upcoming election. Hopefully, after he is reelected, he will take it on with some greater degree of effectiveness.
Mr. Hay, you mentioned a number of times your relations with the White House staff, or lack of, I may say. It was widely known that you did not see eye to eye with Mr. Meese and Mr. Baker and Mr. Deaver on a number of occasions. If you had played political hardball with those gentlemen a bit more successfully, you think you'd still have a job as Secretary of State today?
Well, I don't know. I would hate to suggest that picadillos with the White House staff was the basis of my resignation. I think they contributed, but the real reason was a profound difference in substance between myself and the Reagan foreign policy in the Middle East, in our relations with our allies. Some time ago, and that has since been corrected, our relations with the People's Republic of China, our relationship with our Western industrial powers in the economic sphere, where I felt from day one that our domestic economy and the international economy were intimately interrelated, and you could not deal with one without giving careful consideration to the impact on the other.
Did you feel that you were betrayed?
And that still hasn't been corrected.
Did you feel you were betrayed by the president's men in that situation? Did you feel your message was not getting through and you were being backstabbed, as a matter of fact?
No, I...
You were being played against Mr. Weinberger back and forth?
No. The problems I had was the lack of discipline in the system, the lack of a clear establishment of one voice to articulate American foreign policy and to avoid confusion abroad among our friends and those who do not share our values. A general perception of the United States' role in the world, how we best deal with the Soviet question. And I've always felt that dialogue and negotiation is far preferable to brutal confrontation and a lot of public rhetoric, which does not impress either the Soviets, nor does it make the atmosphere for effective discussion with the Soviets easier.
There's time for about one more question.
Yeah.
You just mentioned that domestic and international economies are interrelated. There's a great deal of support in Marquette County for setting limits on steel imports. I was wondering if you could comment on the effect that might have on Europe and Japan and the effect on the national economy.
Yeah. Well, this will not be well received in this region. But I think that's the kind of comment that Americans need when subjective concerns, and they're very severe ones and very understandable ones in this region, where our mines are in trouble, where our steel production is running into cheaper and in some cases better quality products from Japan, Korea, and the Europeans, and where more importantly Europeans are overproducing and are engaging in unfair practices such as dumping or making steel products available to the American consumer at less price than what it costs them to produce it in order to get a market penetration. All of these things I'm appalled by and I think must be dealt with. The question is, how do you deal with them? Do you deal with them with protective legislation, which will inevitably trigger a trade war and a hemorrhaging of protectionism and reaction by both Japan and Western Europe, which will affect the entire gamut of our trade and monetary relationships. Now, here I think it's the President's responsibility to prevent the hemorrhaging of protectionism. I think it's the American Congress's responsibility to not engage in such petty and highly dangerous international activities. It is the obligation of the President, and he's going to take this problem out of the hands of the experts, as good as they are, and Bill Brock is a very effective negotiator, and take it to the highest levels to be sure that our European and Asian friends adopt appropriate restraint in such a way that American jobs are not in jeopardy, and to make it clear that if they fail to do so, we are going to continue to press in a host of ways, but above all, not to contribute to protectionist devices, direct or indirect, because that's, if one looks back in history, that's precisely what created the seeds that led to the Second War, World War II, and I think we have to avoid it at all costs.
Well, thank you, General.
All right, good to be with you.
Since your book,